Is the Alexander von Humboldt professor in for psycholinguistics at the University of Potsdam, and he is also the founding director of the Potsdam Research Institute for Multilingualism, so brand new and very ambitious, so real competition for us in Germany now. Harald, welcome and thanks for giving your talk, and you enjoy him. Thank you.
Let's see whether you can enjoy me. Can you hear me in the back? Bonjour. This was my French contribution. Where's my talk? Well, thanks very much for having me on this special opportunity. Let me first say that Montreal, and especially McGill, is a place to which I feel closely linked in a number of ways in my research. Firstly, for my work on language acquisition, mainly to Lydia White and her group. I was co-editing Benjamin's book series on language development for a number of years with her. But also for my work on language impairments with Martha Crego, and even earlier with Myrna Gottnick, and for my experimental work with Steve Pinker, who is a very proud Montrealer. The approach I'm taking today is to compare late bilinguals, that is, people who learned a second language as adults, with first language learners, children who learned their native language from birth. This is in some ways a comparison of two extremes, which, I will try to argue, can be particularly revealing, and an approach that Lydia has also taken in her work, although, sadly, she almost always comes to different conclusions than me. So here's an outline of the talk. I will first present some reasons as to why the comparison of adult late bilinguals with children learning their native language is useful. And we'll briefly illustrate that using some of my earlier work on L1 versus L2 acquisition of German. You will hear a bit of German. I will then, in the second part, turn to my more recent experimental work on real-time language processing, and I will again argue that the comparative study of real-time language processing in these two populations can be insightful. And I will illustrate that with some new findings from morphological priming experiments that are not yet published, but have been accepted for publication. In language acquisition research, the comparative study of child L1 and adult L2 learners has quite a tradition. From a psychologist's perspective, the comparison of children and adult language learners is perhaps a bit extreme or even odd. They are probably less clever than adults, children are. They need more time to solve problems. Children seem to be better, on the other hand, at learning many things, not just language. Children receive different and probably more input for language learning than adult language bilinguals, etc., etc. So why compare these two extremes? Well, from a linguistic perspective, the comparative study of these two populations makes a lot of sense and can indeed reveal insights that otherwise are not available. Suppose, and let me explain why, suppose that language contains a component, call it grammar, that is relatively independent of other parts of cognition and also independent of the outside world. Given that, language learners, irrespective of their knowledge of the world or their IQ or their problem-solving abilities or whatever, are simply faced with the same task. namely, as Lydia White put it, to arrive at a linguistic system which accounts for the input. A related question is then why success in the acquisition of grammar as a first language is almost guaranteed, at least in healthy children, whereas for adult late bilinguals, native-like acquisition of a second language grammar is a rare exception. Or, as Jürgen Meisel put it, mission impossible. One attempt to address these questions is the idea that child language acquisition relies on a specialized device, call it universal grammar, to acquire grammatical properties of individual languages. And that this learning device for grammar building is not or not fully available to adults. Instead, late bilinguals have to rely on more general learning principles to learn a second language. If this is correct, or halfway correct, or some of it is correct, then the comparative investigation of first and second language acquisition provides a window for the systematic study of the properties of different learning and knowledge systems. How much of a grammar can you learn with general learning mechanisms? And which parts or components require a specialized acquisition device? Everything? Can you? Something? However, the idea of fundamental differences between first and second language grammar building is controversial. I still believe it's basically correct. Lydia and many others disagree. Let me just give you a flavor of these discussions from studies of acquisition of German clause structure. So German, this is just an illustration from my old work. German is a verb final language that raises finite verbs to the second position in main clauses. So to send a fax comes out as ein Fax senden, English and German being sister languages, with the infinitive in final position. But when you say Paul sends a fax, a sentence containing a tense-marked finite verb comes out as Paul sendet ein Fax, with a finite verb in second position, like in English. Now, we looked at children and adults learning this system. And here, first of all, some information about children. So you can basically divide the development in German child acquisition of this structure into two stages. An early stage, where the MLU is smaller than 3, that's the earliest stage at which one can sensibly examine clause structure. Children are around 2 years of age, and at this stage, most verb forms they produce are non-finite. They're either infinitives or bare stems, as illustrated here in the italicized verbs at the end of the clause. And they very rarely use a very limited number of finite verbs, for example, model verbs such as kann, as in see. So verbs, as you can see, most typically appear clause finally and sometimes in second position. But the second position is only filled by finite verbs, as in see and d. Furthermore, about 40% of subjects, grammatical subjects, are omitted, as you can see in d. Now, if you go a bit further in a child's life, just a few months later, there is a sudden change happening in the development. And I did longitudinal studies to just plot this. Several things happen here at once. One main thing is that the child now has a complete inventory of verb inflections, including the second person singular ST. So that means the child has a productive system for forming finite verbs, which was not there before. The second thing you can notice is that verb placement is like in the adult language. So verb second is the dominant order, and verb placement is in more than 90% correct. We also see a significant drop of subject omissions. So children seem to grasp the SOV clause structure plus verb second very early on, even at the earliest stage at which you can test their productions. And what changes over time is that they need time to learn a productive paradigm to form finite verbs. And this takes time. This is lexical learning. But once this learning component has been successfully achieved, the clause structure is correct. Now, this is one way of learning German clause structure. Now I show you a different way. And this is the acquisition of the same system as a non-native second language, which follows a rather different path. Adult learners of German seem to be sensitive not to the abstract syntactic structure, but rather to surface form properties of the language. In this case, to the fact that subject, verb, object is the most common or canonical sentence type in the language. So underlyingly, linguistically, German is an SOV language, but the most frequent pattern is SVO in the spoken language. And a second language learners pick up on that. So what they initially posit is something like a subject, verb, object, or XVY word order system, in which the verb position can be filled with a finite verb or with non-finite verb. And this system then needs to be altered in a complicated set of stages to accommodate more and more facts of the language as they learn them. So here, non-finite verbs, that is, infinitives, are not restricted to the clause final position, but they may appear in the same position as finite verbs. In my earlier work, I argued that L2 learners with different L1 backgrounds have the same difficulties with German clause structure, even if their L1 would favor them being acquired easily. So Turkish learners, for example, Turkish being an SOV language, still tend to analyze German in L2 acquisition as an SVO system, ignoring the same cues that it is SVO underlyingly that L1 learners pick up so easily. This is illustrated here with some examples from Turkish learners of German who put the verb into a position in which it is neither correct in German nor in Turkish. I should also say that many researchers, including colleagues from Montreal, have tried to present alternative analyses that try to make the two systems, the child developmental trajectory and the adult one, look more similar to each other. But I put here a quote from Meiser, these analyses were less convincing than the original one, the original being ours. I would concur. And thank Meisel for that. Okay, now we come to the second part, which is presenting more recent work. this is the research I'm going to present comes from two recent papers that I did with Gunnar Jakob, who is here, there, and Elisabeth Fleischhauer, who's also working in my lab. And one of them will come out in Bilingualism, Language and Cognition, which I have to edit soon, and Journal of Child Language. Okay. What we look at here is language learners who have definitely acquired the basic properties of the inflectional system under study, although they still produce occasional errors. The purpose of this study was to examine how late bilinguals and children process different kinds of inflected words online. We asked whether language learners are sensitive to an inflected word's internal structure, and whether and how they decompose inflected words into their constituents. We made use of the cross-modal priming paradigm, and I will explain this in detail, which is supposed to tap into the contribution of abstract morpholexical representations during word recognition. We tested German past participle formation. That's the normal German way of forming the past tense, a past tense form, past time reference form, which has some advantageous properties that I will explain in a minute. So here's the linguistic background. Past participles carry one of two segmentable endings, T or N in German. The T suffix is like the English ED, highly productive and readily applies to novel verbs, irrespective of whether they are similar to existing ones or not. So T participles such as getanzt do not have any stem changes. By contrast, verbs that take N participles represent a lexically closed class of items, and N participles only generalize to novel verbs that are similar to existing verbs of that class. That sounds similar. There are N participles that have stem changes, such as geliehen, to borrow, and those that do not have stem changes in the participle, such as schlafen, schlafen. Participles also carry the prefix ge, but this is morphologically uninteresting. This has to do with the prosody, with the syllable structure. Linguists have proposed an analysis of this system in which T participles are formed by affixation and N participles constitute lexical entries. The T rule applies to any element of the category verb, and irrespective of its phonological and semantic properties, and produces a participle form as its output. As Marcos et al. 95 put it, by the same tests that established that ed is the default past tense in English, t is the default in German. So in this experiment I'm going to show you, we tested 72 adult native speakers of German and 108 children in primary school children in two age groups, and 30 advanced L2 learners with Russian as L1. Okay? They were all late learners. There are some scores here if you want to see them in detail in the discussion. They are all very highly proficient. We tested these participant groups on T and N participles with and without stem changes as related test primes, morphologically related test primes, for a first-person singular present tense form of the same verb as the target. So prime target words were getanzt, tanze. There were also two baseline conditions, an identity condition, shown in blue, as a measure of maximal priming, and an unrelated condition in which primes and targets were not related in any way, shown in gray. I hope you can see that, unrelated in gray, as a measure of no priming. And this is how the experiment worked. We changed the usual cross-modal priming paradigm in a way to make this child-friendly. So this is a cross-modal naming paradigm in which, after an attention tone, the prime word was orally presented, and immediately at the offset of the oral prime, the visual target word, so the word schlafer, in that case, appeared on screen. We measured response latencies calculated from the offset of the prime word to the onset of the spoken response when they opened their mouth. With this design, we can investigate cross-modal priming in language learners without asking them to perform any kind of metalinguistic, for example, lexical decision task. Here are the results. I show you the results for the three groups of native speakers first on T and N participles. And we'll look at T participles versus N participles with stem changes. So what you see from the T participles is a significant full morphological priming effect in all participant groups. That is, shorter target response latencies after participle primes shown in red than after unrelated prime words shown in gray, and no difference between identity and participle primes. So maximal priming for T. Okay? When you look at the N participles, we see a reduced priming effect for adults and older children. That is, shorter latencies for participle primes than for unrelated primes, but longer ones than for identity primes. In the younger age group, we see the same numerical difference, but it didn't come out significant, the difference between the red and the gray bar. In addition to that, all groups showed repetition priming effects, that is, shorter response times for identity than for unrelated primes, blue versus gray. Okay, let's now look at the L2 learners, and we see something different. For T participles, remember the native speakers showed full priming, the L2 learners showed a reduced priming effect, okay, like a staircase. For N participles, however, they showed the same partial priming effect as the L1 group. Again, there was repetition priming effects as in the native speakers. So the children behaved like the native adults on the T participles, and the adult non-native speakers behaved like the adult native speakers on the N participles, okay, but not on the T. Let's consider the differences between the various participant groups in a bit more detail. Children differ from mature native speakers in 3 points. Firstly, while children of both age groups had the same priming effect for T, full priming effect for T as adults, a reliable priming effect for N was only found in the older age group. Secondly, as you can see from this little table here, stem changes in participles yielded increased response latencies for younger children, but not for the older ones and the adults. Thirdly, the three groups differed in overall response latencies, with the shortest one for the adults, longer ones for the older children, and the longest for the younger children. The three differences can be attributed to children's developing lexicon and to lexical retrieval becoming more efficient as they get older. This applies to N participles, which are stored in lexical memory, but not to T participles, which are combinatorial forms that are not stored in any way. So hence, these developmental changes affect N, but not T participles. For the adult non-native speakers, we can make two observations. Firstly, the L2 learners had a reduced priming effect for T, unlike the 3L1 groups. Secondly, as you can see from this little graph showing Cohen's D scores calculated on the magnitudes of priming, the L2 group had similar size priming effects for T and for N, whereas the 3L1 groups had larger effect sizes, larger priming effects for T than for N. How can we explain these results? Consider first non-morphological factors. What about response speed differences? This little table at the top of this slide shows that the L2 learners responded overall slower than the L1 adults, but they were actually faster than the two L2 child groups. So the reduced priming effect for T participants in the L2 group cannot be attributed to slowed response speed, because in that case, the children should also show the reduced priming effect for T. Secondly, could shared surface forms between primes and targets be responsible for the observed priming effects? If so, Our participants should show different priming effects for participles with and without stem changes, corresponding to their different degree of orthographic and phonological overlap between prime and target. Geliehen versus geschlafen. This was not the case. We didn't find that. Thirdly, could semantic relatedness between prime and target be the determining factor? If so, our participants should have produced the same amount of facilitation for T and N participles, because the semantics is the same. The semantic overlap is the same. This was again not the case. Finally, can we explain the priming patterns in terms of distributional properties of within the language? Well, I'd say not in an obvious way. T and N are both very common affixes in German. N is even more common than T, as it is also the infinitive ending. And amongst participles, unmarked stems co-occur with both affixes. It's therefore hard to see how we can explain the priming pattern for the difference between T and N in these terms. So we conclude that non-morphological factors cannot account for these results. And now I have 5 minutes to explain what I mean. Yeah?
We have 5 minutes for discussion, or if you want to use the time...
Don't I have like until 9:30? Oh, then my watch is wrong.
During the discussion.
Okay, I take 1 more minute. Okay? This is how I like to explain the L1 results. So we have two different priming routes, one that involves morphological decomposition and one that involves lexically related entries. And this is very simply the way I would explain the L2 results, namely priming without morphological decomposition. And these are my conclusions. And here I stop. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we have a few minutes for questions.
Hello.
Hi, Harold. Are your is your interpretation then similar to the Pinker, et cetera, interpretation with respect to ED over-regularization in English? Because it sounds like you have a dual root explanation.
Yeah, well, it's very similar. But I think the model that Steve Pinker and Michael Ullmann proposed for the English past tense works very well for that language, but it doesn't work so well for languages which have a bit more complicated morphology. And there is also evidence suggesting that this simple division into the irregulars that are all stored and the regulars that are decomposed doesn't work for these more complex systems. I didn't go into that, but even for the T participles, for the N participles, there is evidence that some of them are decomposed and show structurally decomposed entries. So I'd say it is very similar indeed to what they say, but I think the model has to be extended to cover more complex languages.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Lydia.
Hello. I'm not going to talk about German word order. We've been arguing about it for 25 years.
That's true.
I have a question about this. So are you saying that adult second language learners never morphologically decompose, or that with respect to T and N participles, because it seems to me you may well be right, they are not, in other words, they are storing both types as lexical items rather than decomposing either. But that seems to be not particularly problematic. What would be really problematic is if you can show that they never morphologically decompose. So I just wondered if you could comment on that.
This is, yes, I'm not so sure. I mean, what this experiment taps into is automatic processes during rapid word recognition, right? That doesn't mean that if you give them time, for example, in an offline task, they wouldn't, identify in some way the internal structure of an end participle, right? So I'm not, while we are running all these experiments at the moment, I'm kind of modifying and adapting this general claim they can't decompose at all. Because sometimes we get evidence in for decomposition effects. At the moment, it's all a bit in the air. I mean, these differences exist, right? They in word recognition. And when we do masked priming experiment, what I showed you was a cross-modal priming experiment. When we do mass priming experiment, this is tapping into even earlier processes of word recognition. Then the picture is even more consistent. We don't get any decomposition effects in these learners. We don't. At other labs, people get some decomposition effects. So I would say that there is something there, but these differences are real, and I like to pursue this strong hypothesis that they can't decompose as long as I can. And I would only modify it when I'm forced to by evidence. Right?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.